This is Law Bites, a podcast with Michael Geist.
Trade associations in the United States are calling on their government to fight back against Canada's new digital services tax. The tax plans to add a 3% levy on foreign tech giants that generate revenue from Canadian users. But it's not just those in the U.S. that are upset with this new tax. The Ford government is also pushing back. Ontario Finance Minister Peter Bethlenfalvy wrote to his federal counterpart last week. Now is not the time for Canada to put a target on its back. Unilaterally implementing this tax not only imposes new costs on our economy, it could significantly harm our relationship with the United States. Finance Minister Chrystia Freeland responded to those concerns today.
We have specifically been working very hard and very collaboratively with the U.S., and I am confident that a win-win outcome, a negotiated win-win outcome for Canada and the U.S. is absolutely possible.
The battle over a digital services tax has been the subject of several Law Bites podcast episodes over the years, as the Canadian government signaled its intent to move ahead with one, even as U.S. officials warned of the risks of trade retaliation if they did so outside of an international framework. With the DST now in effect, what does trade law have to say, and how might the U.S. respond? Meredith Lilly is a full professor in the Simon Reisman Chair in International Economic Policy at Carleton University's Norman Patterson School of International Affairs. Her research focuses on North American trade relations, and before her appointment to Carleton in 2016, she served as Foreign Affairs and International Trade Advisor to then-Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, overseeing within the Prime Minister's office Canada's free trade negotiations with partners such as the European Union, the Trans-Pacific Partnership, South Korea, and Ukraine. She joins me on the podcast to discuss the current digital trade policy tensions, what our agreements say about complaints and retaliation, and explains why a U.S. response on at least the DST seems likely. Meredith, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks very much for having me.
Thank you for joining. You know, you're really the perfect person to come on board to talk about this issue, because there's been, I think it's fair to say, increased Canada-U.S. trade tensions and the prospect of even tariff retaliation. It's been kind of lurking in the background for some time on a number of issues, I suppose, but certainly in my world, especially around Canadian digital policy, notably involving a new digital services tax and legislation such as Bill C-11. Which has been much discussed on this podcast, that mandates payments by foreign streaming services, and those are predominantly U.S.-based ones. I think it's fair to say this issue is no longer in the background. We've got a CRTC ruling on mandated payments and multiple challenges of that ruling in the courts, and the digital services tax has now taken effect on a retroactive basis, somewhat quietly earlier this month, the government got it going. So why don't we start then with, you know, our trade obligations more broadly, and then we can dive in specifically onto these issues. I'm sure many are familiar with the USMCA or CUSMA and perhaps NAFTA before that. Can you talk a bit about some of our trade obligations with the US and what principles or provisions might be triggered by some of the policies?
Just starting out with kind of the basics of trade agreements, these are largely about the rules that we put in place with our trading partners to regulate trade between us. Our trade relationship with the United States is our kind of oldest, most mature trading relationship, setting aside kind of British past. But our trade agreement with the U.S., is our oldest one, and that dates back to 1987. That agreement was then trilateralized with Mexico in the 90s. And by the time we got to NAFTA, we really had included free trade between Canada and the US, as well as Mexico, across many sectors and areas of the economy. But NAFTA itself didn't contain any provisions around digital trade, because it didn't really existed the way that we think of today. It didn't define digital. It didn't define the internet. Trade in those areas, if it was covered at all, would have been under what we call the services chapter, and it just wasn't subject to NAFTA. And so then USMCA got negotiated, a digital chapter was brought in. That chapter actually was largely lifted almost completely from the Trans-Pacific Partnership because the United States used to be part of that agreement before it withdrew under Donald Trump on his first day of office. And so then moving from those kind of basics of trade and talking about how this relates to the digital piece, I think the most relevant parts of the digital chapter that relate to the legislation that Canada has brought in are in two areas. So one is this idea that the agreement states very clearly that duties can't be charged on imports. But it also states clearly that internal taxes are legal as long as they're consistent with the agreement. So what does that mean? Well, for taxes to be consistent with USMCA and our other trade agreements, they can't discriminate. So, a typical example would be the GST and VAT taxes. Our GST, the VAT in Europe, are legal from a trade perspective. This has been tested at the WTO, and they're considered legal because everyone is subject to them in the same way. And if, on the other hand, we just tax foreign imports, that would essentially be a tariff, and that would be illegal under USMCA. So that's one part of the digital chapter. And then the second principle I think that's important is that this principle in trade that products of a similar nature must be treated the same. So this is, again, this idea of discrimination. You can't discriminate against imported goods or services from another country just because they're imported. And so in Canada, this second principle can get quite muddy when we speak about digital products because a lot of our digital products relate to culture, cultural products, things like music, television, books, and so on. And NAFTA and now USMCA both contain something called the cultural exemption, which allows Canada to impose different policies that would otherwise violate the agreement if we didn't have the exemption in place. And so we can talk about that a little bit more when we get to the Online Streaming Act, but those are kind of the big picture guidance that we have from the agreement about how we implement digital trade in a way that is consistent and open to the other country.
Okay. No, that's super helpful. And we certainly should circle back on the cultural exemption when we talk about streaming and Bill
Sure.
C-11. I want to apply what you've had to say specifically to the DST and C-11 in a minute, but even before we get there, what are some of the what options do countries have if they disagree with one of these policies? So, sometimes you see a bit of the saber rattling, so to speak, that takes place. But if either country, if US or Canada or suppose Mexico, but in this case, let's say the US disagrees with some of the Canadian policies, what options exist under these trade agreements? What actions can be taken?
So, if we didn't have a trade agreement in place, we could go to the World Trade Organization, the WTO, with dispute settlement process. It's not working very well right now, so I'll set that aside. But that's what countries do that don't have formal trade agreements, because we do under USMCA or CUSMA. We have a couple of mechanisms to do that. So one is what's called Chapter 10. It's a trade remedies chapter. This is usually used and leveled at individual firms that are believed to be subsidizing or dumping their product on the market. So when you hear about Canada's softwood lumber debates and disputes with the United States, Chapter 10 is used a lot for that. It was called something else under NAFTA. But that's actually kind of less relevant because it's not quite the right tool that we would use in the case of the disputes that are arising under the DST. So instead, we have something called Chapter 31, and it outlines a formal legal dispute settlement process that allows countries to launch complaints against each other. Panels are developed. They adjudicate just like a court does. I mean, it's a little less formal than a court, but it's the same kind of idea. An agreement, or sorry, a ruling comes down, and you can dispute things like the way USMCA operates, the way that it's implemented quite broadly, and also the way that different parties to the agreement might be interpreting the rules. And so it would be the one that would be most useful today. If a Chapter 31 case was launched against Canada and the United States won that case, then Canada would be required to change its policies and practices to align with the ruling. And if we don't, then the United States is in a would be in a position to retaliate with what we call commercial measures of an equivalent effect. And that usually means tariffs. And it can be on anything. It doesn't just have to relate to the issue of concern. Tariffs can be put on anything. And so we saw this when the 232 tariffs by the United States were brought against Canada, Mexico, other countries on steel and aluminum. Canada was retaliating against things like Kentucky bourbon. Not, you know, it had nothing to do with steel and aluminum, but it had to do with strong political interests and influence in the United States. A couple of other things I think that are relevant when you think about dispute settlement is, you know, don't forget that firms can also launch private litigation against a foreign government if their commercial interests are damaged. They also can just take measures into their own hands and leave, you know, make a decision to say, well, Canada's doing this thing I don't like, so we're going to leave the market, which is what we saw with Facebook and the Online News Act. And then again, you know, coming back to that little cultural exemption piece, dispute settlement actually operates differently when cultural exemption comes into play. And so, again, I keep kind of dangling that one, but we should come back to it.
Okay, so we definitely will. So, but you did mention the DST in particular. So why don't we focus a bit on that for those that haven't focused on it. There have been some podcast episodes that talk a bit about it. It sort of dates back to concerns that many countries, largely outside the United States, have had with the perspective that some of the large multinationals, notably tech companies, the view is that they don't pay their so-called fair share of taxes on the revenues that they generate within a country, which has given rise to this notion of amounts to a surtax on various digital services, digital advertising, or running online markets. We've seen it in a number of other countries, but the U.S. in each instance has sought to either stop it from taking place, potentially try to retaliate. There have been efforts to try to address that issue at the international level through an agreement at the OECD. And finally, in the case of Canada, we didn't move forward with this. There was the agreement at the OECD that basically got us to put any possibility of moving forward with a DST on hold. And essentially, our government's run out of patience with the delays in implementing that international agreement. I think they have some doubts it'll ever be implemented. And so I've now moved ahead with the DST. That issue, really even more than some of the other pieces of legislation, seems to have been something that elicits comments from U.S. elected representatives, senators, members of Congress, U.S. trade representative. It's pretty clear that we're talking about big dollars. Canadian government estimates we're talking about billions of dollars in potential tax revenue. And so the fact that Canada has now moved ahead with this has already sparked quite a significant response. That's the DST. You know, let me just even just throw it open to you, sort of some of your thoughts on where things are at, some of the initial reaction to that, and then perhaps we can get into from a legal trade perspective what some of the possibilities might be.
Yeah, so I mean, I think a couple of the things that are really important to remember, the reason the United States is so upset about this is that the DST really is targeting American firms. A small number of Canadian firms will be impacted by it. You know, the original form of this tax was called in Europe the GAFA, which stood for Google, Alphabet, Facebook, and Amazon. And so the United States, it always has been the target. And even in OECD negotiations, it's largely American firms that are affected. And it is largely the United States that is dragging its feet on moving forward. And so for those reasons, as you say, Canada has gone ahead unilaterally on its own. Why Canada thinks it should be the one to move forward unilaterally is a bit beyond me, but that's kind of a different conversation and more of a my own personal view on that. But a couple of the things that the United States, I think, is really concerned about. One is that, you know, they claim and they say, look, we're still negotiating. We're still at the OECD table. We're still participating in this. So why did you go ahead now of all time? And then the second thing is, and they definitely see this as discriminatory against American firms because the threshold has been set at a level that largely exempts most Canadian companies from having to pay, and really only the largest online marketplaces in Canada will have to pay. And then, but another piece of this that is really, really upsetting U.S. business is that it's retroactive in nature. So the rule that has come into play is that it subjects tax revenues from 2022. So by the time firms actually have to pay this tax, they'll be paying 3 years of tax to Canada, which will certainly be a windfall for Finance Canada, Revenue Canada. So I can see why they're happy about that. But the retroactive nature is seen as unprecedented and really quite problematic. And I tend to agree that it's really quite, from a tax principle perspective, bad behavior. But it is the, you know, this kind of discriminatory piece, which is where the United States is likely to take it.
Okay. So, yeah, and I agree with you that certainly just the pure dollar amount, the fact that comes in part from the retroactivity, as well as the fact that it is by and large, you know, nobody makes much secret about the fact that this is focused largely on U.S. companies. It's not exclusively so, but they're certainly the ones that get hit the most by this. We've seen, you know, a number of different responses from business groups. You mentioned the business groups are upset just in the last few days as we record this. I know that the U.S. Chamber, and we've seen Chamber of Commerce has become pretty vocal on this, have focused on the U.S. Trade Representative, and perhaps we can explain who the USTR is and what role they have, and have asked for a Section 301 review. Can you explain what they're getting at there, and sort of perhaps even what are some of the other kind of approaches or solutions that business groups have been focusing on as they've asked government to get more engaged?
Sure. So, I mean, before I get into the formal U.S. government response, again, firms could act unilaterally if they wanted to, and they could start reducing the prominence of Canadian products in Canadian digital products in the United States if they wanted to immediately. They could say, you know, we're not going to carry your various digital products, movies, whatever it is, in the U.S. market. If they want to send a signal. And there is some concern that Canada going ahead with this could result in a number of other countries also pushing ahead with their digital services taxes. So that's both a reason that firms are wanting to push back firmly, but also the USTR. So the USTR is the United States Trade Representative. It's the current USTR is Katherine Tai under President Biden. And the USTR's role is to advance U.S. interests in trade. There has been talk about what is called a 301 investigation in the States, which is the way that the United States will launch an investigation in order to then gain evidence around what they consider to be discriminatory action towards their own firms, and then it puts them in a legal position to retaliate against that country. And that the 301 was triggered and used with France when it tried to bring in a digital services tax. In the case of Canada, I think it actually is much more appropriate to use the tools of USMCA. Remember, there is no free trade agreement between the United States and the EU that would regulate the digital services tax of France. And so that's why they use the 301. But in Canada, we can use that Chapter 31 that I mentioned. And so it's a multi-stage process. You start by requesting formal consultations. You then launch a panel and you launch a formal case. And so when countries decide to do this, they're weighing a bunch of issues, including just the bilateral relationship generally. Should, you know, the Biden administration go up against the Trudeau government right now at this point in history? USTR has been quite vocal about this. But the digital services tax and its implications actually fall under Commerce and Secretary Yellen. So, you know, there's a little bit of inside politics going on there that we'll set aside, but it does mean that you have to sort of pay attention to who is saying what in the United States when you're interpreting how likely they are to move against Canada and when. Now, having said that, they can go ahead with a Chapter 31 case. They would argue that it discriminates against US firms. One of the challenges that they will have in doing this is that the strongest dispute settlement cases demonstrate evidence of injury legally. So basically, how the tax hurts US companies. The companies haven't yet paid the tax, so they haven't yet experienced injury. So, they can estimate how much it's going to injure them, but until they actually experience injury, a dispute settlement case just isn't as strong legally. So that's one piece that means that this all might take a while to play out through the Chapter 31 process. But a successful ruling would mean that Canada would have to change its rules according to whatever they found. Otherwise, the US would be in a position to retaliate. And again, as I said, the retaliation wouldn't have to be limited to digital products. So they could retaliate against sensitive products to Canada politically. And so this is one of the reasons that this tax is of greater interest to broader business associations and business groups in Canada, and not just kind of the digital players.
Yeah, so the Canadian businesses are, at least one of their concerns may well be that it's their products that may get hit with one of these tariffs if it reaches that point, even though they've got nothing to do with the DST. So it's interesting how it can have that broader effect. When you talk about longer timelines, give me a sense of just how long we're talking about it, in part because might that help explain why you might move ahead with this, essentially. You're daring an action, and you're figuring that, well, it's going to take such a long process anyway. Perhaps it'll be someone else's problem, or by the time you get to that point, you can negotiate your way out of it. I mean, does the length of how long this process take perhaps incentivize Canada to say, hey, we're gonna push the envelope a little bit here because we think it kind of reduces the risk, at least in the short term?
Certainly, I think that Canada wouldn't be forced to make a change right now. And if anything, it would be a political decision. So if the US government pushed back very hard politically through phone calls and interventions at the level of Secretary Yellen and or even the White House, I think that kind of thing could get Canada to stand down and adjust its behavior. But yeah, the long timeline will be an issue in this case, because that injury piece will take a while to demonstrate. Having said that, the USMCA dispute settlement process has been working quite well and has been moving at an okay pace. But the United States is kind of embroiled in an election campaign right now, and so whether this rises to the level of their kind of real policy attention right now, I think, is an open question.
Okay, interesting. I guess the prospect of a review and of tariff retaliation hinges on whether or not there actually is a violation here. Do you have some thoughts as to whether, how strong do you think the US case is? Parking to the side for the moment the question of actual harm that perhaps is yet to come.
Yeah, well, I mean, all of these things we never know until they're tested in law, right? But in this particular case, I think both countries do have a case. So I think the Americans have a case because it largely impacts American firms, and the minimum threshold of firms that are affected are largely American. And so I think the US has a case and has strong reason to say, on what basis does Canada care about the taxation of our global revenue? You can care about the taxation of our Canadian revenue, but why do you care about our global revenue? That should be a multilateral discussion. But I think Canada also has a case. If its tax itself is legal, so if we're allowed to do this regardless of the existence of USMCA, then I think it would argue that no, we're not discriminating against the United States. We've set this level at this minimum threshold level. It affects Canadian firms. It's not our fault that the largest firms in the world happen to be American, and so this isn't a discriminatory tax. I think that's the argument that would go forward. And in the end, our system says until the courts decide, we just don't know.
Okay, fair enough. But and in some ways, not having total certainty here sort of may push both sides a little bit, perhaps away from the brink. because there's no guarantee that you win if you bring a case. And from a Canadian perspective and from a U.S. perspective, perhaps that pushes towards some sort of resolution as opposed to pushing towards the actual claim.
I mean, you did mention the USMCA review. I would say that this issue is going to come up and a resolution will be forced before the review. So the USMCA review takes place in 2026. And if this issue isn't fixed before then, I guarantee it'll get fixed during the review.
Okay. Oh, that's a great, that's a great point to say that the rules themselves are at play, given the prospect of the review, the agreement itself. Let's turn, you dangled out the cultural exemption. Let's turn to it now. People may be familiar with, because it's been part of Canadian policy for some time, this idea that we want to exempt our cultural sector. Although interestingly, in the Trans-Pacific Partnership, in the TPP, when negotiated by the Harper government, they actually did allow for to exclude some of these streaming services specifically on that issue. So it was an issue then. That part's gone. And so now we're faced with Bill C-11, mandated payments for streamers. And as I mentioned, a number of legal challenges that are less trade focused at the moment and more focused on other kinds of concerns that they identify within the way the CRTC is moving ahead. Can you talk a little bit more about how that cultural exemption plays out? Someone might say, well, if things are exempted, why is there an issue here? How actually does this function in practice?
Yeah, so I'm glad that you mentioned that the concerns with the Online Streaming Act are much broader than the trade issues, because there's a whole bunch of pieces with CRTC that people interested in your podcast likely know much more about than I do. But the trade pieces are what interest me. And so from a trade perspective, just a reminder, the Online Streaming Act requires digital platforms like Netflix and Disney and so on to both promote Canadian content and contribute to funding for the creation of that Canadian content. Most of those companies are not able to benefit from the fund that they pay into, which is an issue from a trade perspective. But both pieces of this discriminate against imports to Canada, which would be in contravention of the USMCA if it weren't for the cultural exemption, because the chapter says we won't charge fees and we won't discriminate against products based on their country of origin. But we have this cultural exemption. So what does that mean in practice? We've maintained this exemption that allows Canada to protect and promote cultural industries through things like tax incentives and funding programs. So everyone knows it as Canadian content, right? And the exemption was originally deemed necessary to protect, you know, French-speaking Quebec from being overwhelmed by American culture. And this was a big piece of the origins of Canada-US Free Trade Agreement and then NAFTA. But there's two things about the cultural exemption that I think call into question how this works in the Online Streaming Act. So one is that the language of the exemption was not updated from NAFTA to USMCA. So the exemption, you know, it still exists basically in the same language, but it's totally silent on the treatment of cultural products via digital and internet mediums. So the Canadian government asserts that it still includes digital, those, you know, books and videos and so on just now exist in the digital format, but that's actually never been tested in law. And you've seen legal cases play out over much smaller issues than the failure to define entire sectors like digital and internet. A second piece of this is that the text of the cultural exemption allows the U.S. to retaliate immediately against Canadian measures at an equivalent commercial value. And that has been used to deter Canada from using the exemption. It's the reason that we don't reach for policies that are likely to violate USMCA, because we're worried about American retaliation. And so unlike the digital services tax that we just talked about, what this means is that because Canada triggered the cultural exemption and said, we're allowed to go ahead with these things because of our cultural exemption, the United States now does not need to launch a dispute settlement case against Canada or even await its outcome to retaliate if it chooses. And if it says, no, what Canada is doing oversteps what the cultural exemption is supposed to do. So we're just going to retaliate and we're going to go after maple syrup and wheat and pork and anything else that we want. And of course, online streaming is big business, as we all know, and as we watch Netflix at night and that kind of thing. And so And then again, the other piece of this is that US firms could just go ahead and launch individual action in the Canadian marketplace. And I don't actually rule that out. The other thing they could do is just raise fees on Canadians and say, sorry, everybody, you're paying more because your government is making it more expensive to operate in Canada. So Canadians will pay significantly more for their Netflix subscription than their counterparts in the United States.
Yeah, no, certainly the consumer impact, you know, I think seems pretty likely on some of these services,
for
Spotify
sure.
And some others for sure. So this is something I was not aware of. It's really interesting to hear the differences, especially from a timing perspective. So it sounds like, unlike a DST, which may have more money at stake, but also has a longer process involved in terms of trying to actually move ahead if the US wanted to move ahead with it. Some sort of tariff or retaliation. And then there is even interceding with that, the prospect of the renegotiation of the agreement itself. In the case of culture, in some ways, the prospect of retaliation has already been triggered if there's an acknowledgement that we're relying on a cultural exemption, and there's the prospect of moving forward without having to go through all these other processes.
Exactly. Yeah. So what it requires is for the US government to decide that A, what we're doing violates the agreement, and B, they care enough to want to take action against Canada. And this is where you'll start to see the politics come into play. And so the Biden administration is quite close with the Trudeau government, and that might be influencing the choice to move ahead or not. A future U.S. government may feel differently and might not hesitate to take action immediately.
Yeah. So, you know, why don't we close with this? You know, some were, I think, taken a bit by surprise by the decision to move ahead with the DST.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it was kind of there, and some thought that Canada would just continue to rag the puck a little bit in the hope, so to speak, that they would find a way to resolve this. They moved ahead, of course, anyway, and certainly they've been moving ahead on the cultural side, say that, you know, basically daring the U.S. to respond and making the case that they didn't think it was going to happen. You know, I guess it raises the question, what other alternatives did Canada have? Do you see some mechanisms to try to de-escalate some of these trade tensions? Or is this simply going to move from the realm of trade policy into, as you've pointed to a couple of times now, I think the political realm, and it'll be political choices by Biden administration or a future administration, by the Trudeau government or perhaps a future government, in terms of how these things get sorted out?
Yeah, I think the DST, we can expect action regardless of who is in power in the White House. I think the implications of it are broad, and also because Canadian action signals kind of permission internationally to other countries who might want to go ahead. And so I think the United States, for that reason, is going to be forced to move. And I do think that we're going to see movement on this in some capacity in the next little while. But it was a bit of a surprise to me that Freeland went ahead with the DST. It was kind of, I think you wrote an op-ed, it was a Friday afternoon dump that announced this. Having said that, I did look, and there was an OECD deadline that lapsed. And so I guess the argument is the deadline to reach a negotiation lapsed again. So Canada went ahead just like she promised. But I think that there's less certainty on the other side on the Online Streaming Act. I do think that there might be some commercial players in the Canadian space that are waiting a new government in Canada. I don't think that they anticipate that a future Poilievre government or Conservative government would continue to implement some of the policies and some of the CRTC processes that are in place. And so there might just be a little bit of, we'll wait and see on that one. But I do expect this all to heat up. And again, if some of these issues aren't addressed before the US election, and if we should see an election of Trump, I do think that there would be swift action against Canada. And if it's not dealt with then, it would be dealt with in the USMCA review in 2026.
Okay. So it's coming. We don't know when in some ways, but there are a number of, I guess, points at which, whether electoral, the elections that may have an impact, or deadlines on various trade sorts of things that it seems it's going to bring this to a head one way or another.
Yeah, I guess one just last thing on that is that there is some sense, I think, in pushing Canada on the DST quickly and before firms actually have to write that check to Revenue Canada because, or Receive in general, but once that happens, it's much harder to undo than before it formally takes place. And so I would expect there to be quite a bit of activity over the summer months and into the fall as these rules are getting written, the regulations around how it's all going to work, because the more noise that is made now, the more likely they can send the whole thing sideways and convince Canada to stand down and work multilaterally. And once it's actually in place in law and checks have been written, it's a lot harder.
Now, that is a really interesting point, which suggests that this was certainly a timely discussion because it sounds like that those involved in this issue certainly aren't taking the summer off. Meredith,
Definitely.
thanks so much for taking the time for both explaining trade and how it applies to a couple of issues that sometimes fly a little bit below the public's radar screen, at least with respect to some of those broader trade implications, which, as you suggested, could affect not just those particular sectors, but much more broadly from a Canadian economy perspective.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for the opportunity. These are complicated issues, so hopefully we talked about it in a way that makes sense to a lot of people.
That's the Law Bites podcast for this week. If you have comments, suggestions, or other feedback, write to lawbites@pobox.com. Follow the podcast on Twitter @LawBitesPod or Michael Geist @MGeist. You can download the latest episodes from my website at michaelgeist.ca or subscribe via RSS at Apple Podcast, Google, or Spotify. The Law Bites podcast is produced by Gerardo LeBron LeBoy. Music by the LeBoy brothers, Gerardo and Jose LeBron LeBoy. Credit information for the clips featured in this podcast can be found in the show notes for this episode at michaelgeist.ca. I'm Michael Geist. Thanks for listening, and see you next time.